Hey folks, welcome to today's episode of Pearls and Perspectives. In honor of September being Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, I have Dr. Van Kasabian here with us today. Van, say hello to the crew.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me.
So we connected through someone who actually works at your office who had seen our podcast and said, hey, we have one of our colleagues at our institution who's doing a lot of cool things when it comes to advanced prostate cancer. Let's get him on the podcast. And here we are.
Sounds great.
So I'm going to introduce, I'll give a brief introduction, you know, to the people watching in terms of who you are. And then I want you to add any other nuggets that you feel like would be interesting for our viewers. So welcome to today's episode. I have Dr. Van here with us today. He serves as the director of the Atlanta Prostate Cancer Center and Advanced Therapeutics at Advanced Urology. And he specializes in complex urologic cancers and novel therapeutics and does a lot of work in the advanced prostate cancer space. He is also nationally recognized as a surgeon and pioneer in high-intensity focused ultrasound. Anything that you want to add to that intro?
Sure. I'm very passionate about community practice, private practice. I've been in academics before, and I'm very passionate about community practice. I'm actually on the board of LUCPA, which is Large Urology Group Practice Association. So we're trying very hard to keep private practice alive and well and compete in the marketplace.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, and I want to know more because for a lot of people watching, a lot of people who are young in their training, right, or finishing their training are so impressionable, and they're trying to figure out what type of practice setting should they enter into. Like, what's your take on that? We want the real scoop here.
Yeah, so your options coming out of training right now are either you go into academic medicine or you join a hospital system. Or you join a private practice that is fully independent or perhaps integrated with a hospital system or even private equity in the background. So these are really your options coming out of training. Each one has its advantages and disadvantages. It really comes down to what you're looking for and what are you comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what do you think like a major advantage of each of those settings would be?
Yeah, so the major advantage, I believe, is with the private practice, with or without private equity in the background. Private equity has gotten a bad name in the last several years, but there's, in my opinion, just like anything else, there's good private equity in the background, and there's bad private equity in the background. I can name you some bad examples in Jersey and the Philadelphia area, and I can name you some good examples of several practices in the country that are using private equity to their advantage to stay competitive in the marketplace. The advantage of a hospital system is you just punch in and punch out. You don't have to worry about, you know, am I going to hire my next nurse? Am I going to hire my infusion? Who am I going to hire for my accounting? Who am I going to hire for my CEO, administrative person? You don't have to worry about that. You just come in, do your work, and go home. However, you're going to be well compensated, at least at the beginning, but then you're at the beck and call in terms of what your activities are going to be, what your salary is going to be, because that typically is renegotiated every several years. And then, of course, there's, you know, just being fully with a private equity or industry, for example, is another example that I left out. If you go into industry, typically they like to have you be in clinical practice at least for a while to get the sense of what it is to be a doctor in the real world, and then some doctors transition to industry. So you got to be careful. The good thing is right now there's a shortage of urologists, of physicians in general around the country. So the starting salaries are really crazy currently. But if you go into a hospital system, that's usually ranched down after a few years. If you go to private practice, that's usually ranched up. If you go into become a partner or invest in other activities outside of the patient care perspective, what has happened over the last decades or so is academic urology is becoming more like private practice, and private practice is becoming more like academic urology. For example, in our practice at Advanced Urology in Atlanta, we have subspecialists for every disease state. I do the big open cancer surgeries and some niche prostate stuff, advanced prostate cancer. We have excellent robotic surgeons So the days of one urologist doing everything are gone. So we're becoming subspecialists within our field. And then in academia, because of the cuts in funding for research and everything else, they are very now interested, which they didn't used to be as much, to the bottom line, to the financials. So they're looking to us for advice on how to manage a business of medicine, of urology practice. And we are looking to the AUA, for example, Lucbay, is to bridge that gap between academics and private practice, because at the end of the day, we're in this together. We're fighting external forces, be it the government or payers or compliance or insurance companies or malpractice attorneys. Everybody sort of around us is targeting at us for different reasons. And we're sort of fortunate in urology to have ancillary services that, say, a general surgeon doesn't have. We can bring in research. We can bring in advanced prostate cancer in-office dispensing pharmacy. We can bring in PSMA scans to our practice. We can bring Pluvicto, which is a treatment for advanced prostate cancer, into our practice. We're fortunate to be able to do all this and to keep it in-house.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting that you made that comment about academic urology becoming more similar to private practice and vice versa. And it makes so much sense. I just have never heard someone verbalize that before. And not only are you talking about the subspecialization within private practice, but your practice is also involved in clinical trials. And I think so many people think, I mean, I thought this as well. I wanted to go into academics because I'm curious and I want to contribute to research. And yet so many private practices are the ones driving clinical research. Can you touch a little bit more on that?
Sure. I mean, put it this way. I did much more research in private practice than I ever did in academia. In academia, it takes about 6 months or more for the IRB to get approval for your trial. In private practice, it took me 2 or 3 weeks using outsourced IRB because I didn't have to work through a big hospital system or academic center. So just the speed at which you can do things is much easier and much faster. Now, you're going to be accountable for the bottom line. If the study loses money, you lose money. If the study makes money, you share in those profits. But I think research for private practice, that's where the patients are. We are in the trenches. We see these patients on a day-in, day-out basis. We have the volume. LUCPA knows this. And we have to be able to leverage this ability to see patients and care for them through our scale. Now, some practices do research well. Some practices don't. Some can make a lot of money. Most make a little money or lose a little bit of money. I think for those who are in that last boat, it adds so much added value to your practice, to your recognition in the community, that's a no-brainer for you to do research, even if you lose a little money or break even. But if you do it right, you can share in that profit.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to go back to a comment that you made earlier in terms of good private equity and bad private equity. How do people tell the difference?
Yeah, you have to be careful who you go to bed with, I guess, is the bottom line. What are they bringing to the table for you? Are they going to be able to do something that you're not able to do? Whether it's contacts, whether it's payers, whether it's just running a practice. If you already are a really well efficient one practice, private equity sort of may not be as important for you as a practice who, look, we can't figure this out. We're getting, you know, squeezed by all corners of the market. We need some help. And what are they bringing to the table? What are they going to be able to do for you that you're not able to do yourself?
Mm-hmm.
That's really what you have to answer.
Mm-hmm. So let's delve into the advanced prostate cancer space, because you mentioned a lot of these other ancillary services. And I think for a lot of us, I mean, I'm not in the advanced prostate cancer space, but you mentioned all these things. And I think most providers would love to be able to offer all of these services. But let's talk about like the bottom line here. How difficult or easy is it to offer some of these service lines?
It's very easy, even in a one or two man practice or person practice, I should say, you can start an in-office dispensing pharmacy. Look, I was trained as a urologic oncologist, but in surgery. I was a surgical oncologist. So I would do a lot of, back in the day, open radical prostatectomies. We had ADT in the form of injections. You know, back in the day, we had Lupron, for example. And that's all we had for advanced prostate cancer patients, right? I mean, look how long it took. It took decades to go from whether it's surgical orchiectomy or medical orchiectomy to fast forward to 2010 when we began to have Provenge and then all the androgen receptor inhibitors. So all these therapies now came in the urology space, because in between ADT and 2010, we had chemotherapy, which was in the medical oncology office. Taxotere was approved, I think, in 2004. And then in 2010, we had Provenge, which was an infusion. It scared a lot of urologists, but we're the experts. We see prostate cancer every single day of the week. If you take a typical, this is what a urologist don't understand. If you take an average medical oncologist, GU malignancy is 5% of their practice because they see breast, they see colon, and they see lung. We don't see any of that. So I see prostate, kidney, bladder all day long. So it was an easy adjustment to me being not just trained as a urologic oncologist, but passionate about the disease, passionate about taking care of my patients. Why am I going to send this patient to medical oncology when I can do this myself? And this was a very profound moment for me, because back in the day when I had a patient progress to metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, this must have been maybe 2011 or so, I was using Provenge, and we only had Provenge, and then we had Taxotere. That's all we had back then. So the question back then is, when do we give Provenge? When do we give Taxotere? And this is, I had a patient I'd known for over 10 years. I diagnosed him with prostate cancer. I did his biopsies, his surgeries, his treatments, and everything. And then I finally, when I got done with him, I had nothing else to offer him. I sent him to the medical oncologist for chemotherapy. He came back to me. He said, "Why did you send me there? It is so depressing." And this was an eye-opening experience, right? He said, and I realized, okay, my waiting room, you look outside my waiting room, there's people waiting to have vasectomies. There's kidney stone patients. There's patients who couldn't pee and now can pee. They're happy. They're all ambulatory. You look in the medical oncology office, what do you have? You have patients with all these different malignancies, alopecia, they're cachectic, they've got G-tubes, they've got, you know, all these kind of things. It's a very depressing lobby, right? And you think about that. And this was very profound to me, because I had known this patient for over 10 years. He said, "Why did you send me that?" It was like, I felt like I dumped him off. Now that we have all these other therapies, we're taking care of these patients and then transfer them to medical oncology. Look, this is a multidisciplinary space, right? I use my radiation oncologist when needed. I use medical oncology when needed. But this is a team approach. But it's not just, I'm just washing my hands. You've got now metastatic disease. You go see another doctor. No, I'm a urologist. I know how to treat prostate cancer pretty much from diagnosis to death. Mm-hmm. That's what's important. You have to be passionate about it. You have to know it. And it's not for every urologist. You have to designate somebody in your practice who really wants to do this.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to ask you, because what is the required infrastructure in terms of like support staff and healthcare providers required to be able to offer that level of care?
Yes, you definitely need support staff. So in our case, for example, because we do all these therapies, we need not just an infusion nurse for infusions. We need a nurse navigator to take care of these patients, to have touch points with the patients. Hey, how are you doing? How was your infusion? You missed your dose of ADT. What's wrong? Are you coming in? Are you doing okay? So it takes a lot of support staff. But if you do it properly, it pays for itself and then some, because you're dispensing these drugs through your in-office dispensing. So rather than using a specialty pharmacy when you don't have to, you're billing and collecting for these drugs, and it's not only taking care of your patients properly, better than anybody else can, because you know these patients, you're making a profit on the back end, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm. And you have imaging technology in your office as well?
Yes, we do.
So I can only imagine the cost of a scanner in an office. Like, how long does it take to recoup the funds for like a PSMA scan?
So look, we are about to launch our PSMA scan, go live probably next month with our first patient. The scan, if I'm not mistaken, was, you know, well over $1 million, about 1.5. But you do the pro forma. You have your administrative and accounting people do the pro forma. What does it cost to what's the cost to go live? What do you have to do to recoup the money from the payers? How much do you get paid? What's your profit margin? So you have to do the pro forma for something like a PSMA scanner to make it worth your while. The good thing about PSMA scanning is now that Pluvicto got FDA approval in the pre-chemo space, you have to fail an androgen receptor inhibitor plus ADT and metastatic CRPC to qualify, but you don't need to have chemo, which is really good because that's where the majority of these patients are. So you're going to be making profit on not just the actual image, but on the therapeutic, the theranostics as well. Mm-hmm. So you have to look at the pro forma of both of these together. So it's a good time to be a urologist in private practice, as long as you know what you're doing and you have the right team to be able to do this and take really good care of your patients.
Mm-hmm. Now, advanced prostate cancer used to be way simpler, right? You mentioned even like 15 years ago, there were essentially two options, and now there are several options. So at what point are you able to offer some of these newer therapies in the office? Like, how much research is needed before you say, this is a treatment we're now going to offer in a private practice situation?
Yeah. So you don't need to be doing the trials to offer it. Typically, when something gets FDA approved, it's open to all urologists. But if you can incorporate it into your practice, it's a win-win. So basically, we do everything for advanced prostate cancer except chemotherapy. That's sort of the only thing we decided not to do. But there are other urology practices that have medical oncologists in-house that offer chemotherapy as well as all these other therapies. So it really depends on your marketplace, what you want to do. But it's very easy. It doesn't take much to get an IOD up and running, because these are all oral pills that you're prescribing. The infusions obviously are a little more complicated. PSMA is more complicated. Pluvicto is more complicated. So that will take scale and numbers to make that work. But even a one or two man group can get an IOD up and running. And many more practices have done so in the last several years. We started our IOD in my old practice, I'm going to say 2013, 2014. And it's been fantastic ever since. And in my new practice, we have this very robust program as well. Mm-hmm. So there are certain things you'll be going to be able to do in a smaller group, but it'll take a bigger group to do some of the bigger stuff like infusions or PSMA.
Mm-hmm. So for the new therapies that are coming out for advanced prostate cancer, how well are they tolerated?
Yeah, so each one has complications, right? You need to know what those side effects are. By no means I'm minimizing these side effects, because some of them can be serious. For example, the immuno-oncolytics, they can cause diabetes, type 1 after one dose. I've seen that happen in one patient. So you have to be able to not only understand, but pick up on these side effects. We're not expected to treat every side effect of these therapies. For example, if a patient gets diabetes, well, I'm not going to manage their diabetes. In this case, the patient ended up sick in the emergency room. He was found to have diabetes. We got our consultants on board, endocrinology, and now he's being managed. So some of these are treatable. Because diabetes is treatable. Pneumonitis with an IO is typically scarier and more life-threatening. But you have to be aware, and this is where our nurse navigators come into play. They have touch points with these patients, making sure they're doing okay. We have a protocol. We have labs drawn every so often for each of these drugs to make sure that, you know, they're not hypothyroid on their androgen receptor inhibitor, for example. That's typically subclinical, asymptomatic, but it can add to their fatigue. So you have to set up a protocol. You have to have touch points, and you have to be able to refer out to your colleagues when necessary. Just like they call you when they need a stent put in, I send them out for their diabetes or hypothyroidism to their respective physicians.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask, you need
to manage it. You just need to know about it.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this, because your office is managing a lot of these therapies now, how does that relationship change between medical oncology if then you're requesting their help, you know, maybe further down the road?
Yeah, most of the relationships are collegial. We live in Metro Atlanta, a lot of oncology groups, so we use different ones depending on where the patient lives, where they want to go, what relationship, if any, they've had before. It's a very collegial, collaborative teamwork. They're not hurting for business. We're not hurting for business. We're all sort of playing in the sandbox together to make our patients, you know, our number one priority.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, I offer IO, so do a medical oncologist, but if a patient prefers to go to their medical oncologist because they have a relationship or it's closer to home, I have no problem with that as long as the patient is getting the proper therapy at that point in time. Mm-hmm. That's what's important. If you put the patient number one, everything else follows.
What are you currently most excited about when it comes to the advanced prostate cancer space?
Yeah, so obviously I'm really interested in Pluvicto and us doing PSMA scans and Pluvicto. That I think is the next big thing. But I'm really excited about bladder and kidney. So we're in the time space now where bladder and kidney cancer is where prostate cancer was 15 years ago. We have all these therapies now in not just muscle invasive bladder cancer, but in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, kidney cancer. These therapies are coming into this in our space as well. It's a great time to be not just a urologic oncologist, but also patients are lucky in the time frame because, you know, look at it. 20 years ago, we didn't have anything for these patients, right? For bladder or for prostate. So oncology is becoming very, I would say, specific therapies, targeted therapies, rather than the shotgun approach of chemotherapy. You know, immunotherapy is such a perfect example. ADT in the pathway of androgen receptor sensitivity is a specific targeted therapy. That's where medicine is headed. That's where cancer care is headed. The next big thing that I'm excited about in cancer therapy is, you know, Amy, God forbid you get a cancer, but we'll be able to sequence the genes of that cancer and tell you, oh, treatment A is not going to work, but treatment B is going to work. And those days of having 1,000 patients on a trial to find out which patient works and what subpatients responded to treatment A or B, those days are going to be gone, thankfully. This is going to be done in the lab, gene sequencing, tumor-specific sequencing, and then we're going to be able to target those patients better and more appropriately.
Mm-hmm. So much of the innovation is on the medical side of these GU cancers. And it seems like every type of cancer that you've mentioned is so much more complex now. So are you seeing more people that are going into urologic oncology really focusing on a specific organ? Do you think that's where it's going?
So yes and no. So in medical oncology, you do have a few GU medical oncologists specific to GU. But the vast majority of oncologists see everything and do everything. A good example is take a GYN cancer, right? The oncologists, they're the gynecologists, they're the surgeons who also give the chemo for their patients with GYN malignancy. They're not referring out to medical oncology. I don't see that being our case. But what I do see is more subspecialization among medical oncologists, but I also see maybe they should do it by treatment rather than disease state, right? You have, for example, the IO expert in medical oncology or the chemo expert, that may be a little bit far-fetched, but that's not an improbability either, right? Because using the same IO drugs for breast cancer, for prostate cancer, for ovarian cancer, so it's no longer, you know, disease-specific. It may be mechanism of action-specific that may be what you should be worried about and specializing in. It's a different way of looking at it, but we're definitely headed to more subspecialization, at least in medical oncology. In urology, maybe not so much. Now, in some practices in LUTPA around the country, there's advanced prostate cancer specialist like me, but there may be a separate bladder cancer specialist. He or she may be doing all the radical cystectomies, but also doing the infusions for IOs for these patients. It's a mixed bag. It sort of depends on how the practice is set up and who the physician champion is and what they feel comfortable doing. But to your point, Amy, it is getting very complicated and you have to know what you're doing.
Yeah. So do you feel like in the surgical space of GU oncology, are there innovations that are just as significant or impactful as on the medical side, or is a lot of this on the medical side?
A lot of it is on the medical side. I mean, if you look at the literature for robotic prostatectomy, for example, when the robot came, it solely started to replace open surgery. And I made a conscious decision that I was not going to become proficient in robotic surgery. I didn't think it added much in terms of continence rates, potency rates. It was just a different technique to do it. And if I look at my younger robotic surgeons in my practice now, it's like playing a video game, and they're fantastic at playing video games. I mean, they can remove a prostate in no time. The patient can be discharged the same day or the next day. But the continence rate doesn't change. The erection rate doesn't change. That really depends on the technique of the surgeon. But if I were to have a prostatectomy today, I would definitely choose a robotic prostatectomy. But beyond that, there isn't much. Now, there are other technologies that may replace focal therapy that's already approved, that's on the horizon, which will decrease the number of radical prostatectomies, robotic prostatectomies done on an annual basis, because prostate cancer, at least localized prostate cancer, is moving towards focal therapy or ablative therapies and away from radiation and away from surgery. That's a big step, but really if you look at the bigger picture, the bigger steps are on the medical oncology side with the advanced drugs that we have for advanced prostate cancer. Mm-hmm.
So what would your message be to, let's say, like mid-career urologists as these new technologies are coming out? How do you know when you're going to just like, you know, learn to pick up a new technique?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I've been in practice for over 3 decades. And I will tell you, every 10 years or so, I have to pivot what I want to do, what I'm going to offer my patients, not just to stay relevant, but to take better care of my patients. If you don't adapt, if you just stay in your sandbox and if you just learn what to do now and think you're never going to change what you do in your career, you're going to be a dinosaur. You're going to be dead in the water. So you have to adapt with technology, because at the end of the day, patients are going to demand it because it's in their best interest, and you have to adapt accordingly.
Mm-hmm. And as urologists, I mean, I think a lot of us go into the field because we're early adopters and innovators of new technology, but sometimes the barriers, once we're just used to doing what we're doing on a day-to-day, are more challenging. Now, I don't know what it is like in the Atlanta area. I know in the Miami area, I treat all the quality of life concerns, right, like surrounding this and other urologic issues. And I find that a lot of my patients are not getting the nuanced approach that they need when they have an elevated PSA. So there's still, you know, are so many providers that are not getting like a prostate MRI. And just like, it's hard to know exactly what my role is other than to say, look, I'm not trying to step on your local urologist's toes. Times are changing, and I recommend you get a second opinion. I don't know how much of that you're seeing in Atlanta, but people are not necessarily up to speed with the current recommendations.
Right. Typically, patients trust their physician, especially if they've had a relationship with them. That physician may not be up to date on how to manage elevated PSA. They may not know of it. But just to touch on the MRI, I love MRI. I use a ton of MRI, not just for diagnosis, but for focal ablative therapies. The MRI is so dependent on the reader. So there's radiologists is so critical to the proper interpretation. And that's where the issue comes. And there's been a lot of data published about this as to, you know, a lot of errors in inter-radiology interpretation at an MRI. There's the MRI technique, there's the machine, and then there's the radiologist. Just to touch on this for a second, this is where I see AI come into play. So we use AI quite a bit. One of the ways that we use it is when we load now our MRI into our ultrasound system for targeted index lesion biopsies, the AI may actually pick up a lesion on the MRI that was missed by the radiologist. So my point is, I think AI is going to be very important in radiology and pathology. It's not going to do away with the pathologist, and it's not going to do away with the radiologist, because you're still going to need a human to oversee what the AI is doing. But think about this. A CAT scanner is a computer-generated image, right? Why are you having a human interpret a computer-generated image? Have the computer interpret it. Let the human sign off on it. That's really where we're going. And that's the same with histology. You put a slide under a microscope, you teach AI what to look for, what pattern to look for, and it's probably going to do it better than a human, but you still need the human for the nuances. Just like, I'm not sure we're ready for a completely automated robotic surgeon, right? Because there's so many nuances in surgery. But this is where radiology and pathology is headed, is AI.
Mm-hmm. When I think about imaging, I know we're told during training that ultrasound is very technologist dependent, right? But I don't think we're oftentimes, or I don't have an appreciation for how much a CT scan and an MRI are actually, you know, like protocoled and all. And there's so many variables that go into that and the imaging and the reading of it.
Right, right. Absolutely. It's critical. It's critical. And more and more your radiologists are becoming better, I think. It's just with practice. But you still need somebody you trust as a radiologist to be reading your MRIs. It's very reader dependent, even to this day. It's gotten better, but it's still very reader dependent. But again, I think AI is going to solve this issue for moving forward.
Yeah, I love that. So the last topic I want to tackle here is along the subject of cancer survivorship and a lot of the patient populations we've discussed, especially the guy who has advanced prostate cancer. So in this whole team that you have, how are you making sure that this guy doesn't become frail, fall down, and break a hip?
Yeah, so falls and fractures are high on the side effect profile of not just ADT, but all these other therapies that we add. For example, all the MRIs increase your falls and fracture rates. They increase cardiac toxicity, CVA rate, stroke. Everything else goes up higher than just ADT alone. They're small numbers, but they're not insignificant. So back in the day when we started advanced prostate cancer clinics, we weren't sure what to name them. So one of the names we'd come up with initially before we had all these therapies was a bone health clinic, right? Because you're giving ADT, you need to make sure that they're taking calcium, they're taking vitamin D. So our blood work for an advanced prostate cancer patient includes not just PSA and testosterone, it includes calcium and vitamin D levels. So we see this every 3 months. In fact, just yesterday, I saw a patient whose vitamin D was low, and I asked him, are you taking your vitamin D supplements? And he said, no, but I'm taking a multivitamin. And the multivitamin probably didn't have vitamin D, but it probably was enough. So I told him to take an additional vitamin D tablet on its own. So it's very important to remind the patients that bone health is still very part of what we do. Exercise, mild to moderate exercise for strengthening your bones is extremely important, even for a patient who has bony metastatic disease, especially if they've had a great response to therapy. So we do as much as we can to make sure. But in general, urologists, medical oncologists, even primary care physicians don't do enough of a good job in maintaining bone health for our elderly patients, even when they're not on advanced ADT or prostate cancer therapies. But it's a very good point that you make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting topic because so often in our conferences and society meetings, we talk about how does our treatment approach to the older, frail patient change? And I would love to flip that script and say, how do we prevent our patient from becoming frail to begin with? You know, so I'm like a huge proponent of talking about nutrition and exercise and specifically what exercises are good for bone health, because I have plenty of patients, they get on their elliptical and they're doing, you know, they're the little like elliptical bunnies, which is not going to be good for bone health. It needs like foot to pavement, jump training types of, you know, of workouts. So I think maybe that's sort of like the next frontier is talking more about like the specifics of nutrition, supplementation, and exercise. And it's interesting because we think about that as being innovative, and yet it is the foundation. So sometimes it's taking a little bit of a step back to become more innovative.
Correct. And sometimes we overlook the simple things that are important in a patient's life, right? Like bone health.
Yeah.
It's so important, right, to avoid a fall and a fracture. So important.
Any final messages for our viewers today?
Yeah, I think urology is changing for the better. I'm going to speak to the younger guys because I'm at the end of my career. When you finish training, it's not the end. It's the end of a chapter. And this is the big beginning of your career. And you need to be the forefront of taking good care of your patients, which includes advanced prostate cancer therapies. So I'm not asking all urologists, all trainees to become proficient in this, but you need to have a few young leaders for the next generation.
Mm-hmm. Where can people find out more information about your practice and what you're doing?
So we have our website, Advanced Urology. But LUCPA has great resources on our website as well. Come to our annual meeting. We'll have a lot of stuff in Chicago in November on advanced prostate cancer. And there's regional meetings that you can come to. There's just different avenues where you can get more information and help and support to start taking care of your patients in a better way.
And are trainees invited to these LUCPA events as well?
Yes, we actually have resident summits. So we invite residents. That's their meeting. A few of them from around the country come. It's a networking opportunity and a chance to learn of what's coming down the pipeline.
Awesome. Dr. Kasabian, it was so great talking with you today. I appreciate your time and thank you for joining us today on Pearls and Perspectives.